Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In the appendix to his Prolegomena to any future metaphysics, so we're getting very, very close to the end of the work, Immanuel Kant is going to engage with one of the many critics of his critique of pure reason. And one of the things that he's going to do in this, that he's already done a bit earlier in the work, but I think is quite useful to go over since Kant goes back into it, is to clarify what he means by idealism in relation to other idealist thinkers. And as it's going to turn out, as you'll see, Immanuel Kant's version of idealism is going to be not only quite different, but as he is going to say towards the end of this section, my so-called properly critical idealism is of quite a special kind in that it reverses the usual idealism and through my kind all a priori cognition, even that of geometry, first receives objective reality, which without my demonstrated ideality of space and time could not be maintained by the most zealous realists, right? So he is telling us two things there. First is that realism requires the kind of critical or transcendental idealism that Kant himself is putting forward. But the second thing is that what he means by idealism, the term that he's using, is almost directly opposite to, opposed to what other previous thinkers have called idealism and which the contemporaries of his own time are thinking that Kant is perhaps endorsing by using that term. So we begin with this interesting quote from it. He says, "In order to take a position from which my review could most easily set the whole work, the Critique of Pure Reason, in a most unfavorable light without venturing to trouble himself with any special investigation, he begins and ends by saying, this work is a system of transcendental, or as he translates it, of higher idealism." And then there's a footnote here. Kant actually tells us, by no means higher. High towers and metaphysically great men resembling them, round both of which there is commonly much wind, are not for me. So he's saying, I'm not trying to raise things. Instead, he says, my place is the fruitful bathos of existence. What is bathos? Depth. That's a Greek word that's used in aesthetics, but it also literally means going deeper. And the word transcendental, the meaning of which is so often indicated by me, but not once grasped by my reviewer, does not signify something passing beyond all existence, which would be transcendent, but rather something that indeed precedes it a priori, intended simply to make cognition of experience possible. And he says, we have to distinguish here between transcendent and transcendental. So he's really going after his reviewer, and this prompts him to ask the question, well, what sort of idealism goes throughout my entire work? What is it that I am doing? And he says, it does not by a long way constitute the soul of the system of my work, but it does go throughout the entirety. So we're going to get a really important contrast developed here between, interestingly, what he calls genuine idealism. The German term there is echt, right? So authentic idealism. And what is the implication here? Kant's idealism is not genuine idealism. It's something different. So he says that the principle that the dictum of all genuine idealists from the Eleatic school, so we're talking about Parmenides and those going onward, all the way to Bishop Berkeley, is contained in this formula, All cognition through the senses and experience is nothing but sheer illusion, and only in the ideas of the pure understanding and reason is there truth. Now, you could also call this a kind of rationalism as well, perhaps, but he's labeling this idealism. And what is the dictum, the principle that is running throughout his idealism? It's the exact opposite. It is a reversal of this. All cognition of things merely from pure understanding or pure reason is nothing but sheer illusion. So we have something being identified as illusion, but in this case, it is the exact opposite of what the other kind of idealism is identifying as illusion. And only in experience is there truth. So this is a really important reversal as well as distinction that is taking place here. And he says this is directly contrary to idealism proper. And then he's going to address a question that the reader would bring up. Well, why are you calling what you're doing idealism? Why did I use this expression for quite an opposite purpose? Why did my reviewer come to see it everywhere? And he says, well, you know, the reviewer is kind of sloppy. Had he actually read it attentively, he would see what is going on here. And so what is it? Space and time, together with all that they contain, this is Kant's doctrine, are not things in themselves or their qualities, but merely belong to the appearances of things in themselves. Up to this point, he says, I am in confession with the above idealists. Here's where I'm in agreement with idealists, but here is where the reviewer didn't pay close enough attention. So he says, these and among them, more particularly Berkeley, regarded space as a mere empirical representation. So an empirical representation, what we get through our experience, a mere empirical representation that, like the appearances it contains, is, together with its determinations, known to us only by means of experience or perception. So how do we get to know space? First we experience, and then what we do experience is space, and then we construct the idea of it in our mind. But space is kind of illusory from this perspective. So he says, I, on the contrary, prove in the first place that space, and not only space, but time, which Berkeley didn't pay adequate attention to, didn't consider, and all of its determinations can be cognized a priori, prior to any experience, independent, you might say, of any determinate experience by us. Why? Because no less than time, it inheres, as he says, in us as a pure form of our sensibility before all perception of experience, and it makes possible all intuition of sensibility. So you don't have sensibility first and then get space and time. You've got to have space and time first, and then you can actually have intuitions within our faculty of sensibility. So he says then, it follows from this, as truth rests on universal and necessary laws, that for Berkeley, so we get another really important contrast here, for Berkeley, experience can have, as he says, no criteria of truth. And what does that actually mean to us here? Its appearances have nothing a priori in their foundation. There's no sort of structure. There's no sort of manifold, we might say. So if this is the case for Berkeley, experience is nothing but sheer illusion. And I leave it to you to decide, if you've read Berkeley, whether this is really a fair and adequate understanding of his point of view. But this is what Kant says about it. Now, how is Kant contrasting his own position on space and time? Here is what he tells us. For it follows that with us, space and time, not only by themselves, and this is very important, in conjunction with the pure concepts of the understanding, right? This is something we saw earlier. You need the categories, you need the concepts to be having experience and not just perception through sensibility. So they prescribe their law a priori, once again, outside of experience, to all possible experience, and at the same time afford the certain criterion for distinguishing truth from illusion therein. And then there's another interesting footnote here that we should, in fact, take a close look at. He says, idealism proper, so not Kant's idealism, but Berkeley all the way back to the Eleatics and Parmenides, idealism proper always has a mystical tendency and can have no other. That's the direction that it's going in. But mine, my idealism, is designed for the purpose of comprehending the possibility of our a priori cognition of objects of experience, which is a problem never hitherto solved or even suggested. In this way, all mystical idealism falls to the ground, for, as may be seen in Plato, it is inferred from our cognitions a priori another intuition different from that of the senses, an intellectual intuition, which Kant is rejecting. Interestingly, some of the later German idealists will take this idea of intellectual intuition back up, and he says, it never occurred to anyone the senses themselves might intuit a priori. So what do we have here? We've got clarifications about what exactly idealism is. We've got two different styles or brands of idealism, the Kantian transcendental or critical idealism, which isn't really idealism in its proper or genuine sense, running from Parmenides all the way up to Bishop Berkeley. And they are not only different in kind, but they actually are reversals of each other in what they presuppose and what they set forth as the truth of things. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.